You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Carol Downer is nothing less than a legend. She is not only a lawyer and an author, but she revolutionized the women's health movement, learning how to perform abortions and vaginal self-examinations, and teaching other women how to as well. In the early 70s, at a time when abortion, birth control, and fertility information were not widely available to women, Carol and some other women developed the practice of menstrual extraction, offering women a means to take control of their reproduction. She and her group, later incorporated as the Feminist Women's Health Center, traveled around the U.S., equipped with vaginal speculums, teaching women about their bodies and reproductive systems. The FWHC also established the Women's Abortion Referral Service, the first of its kind to offer pregnancy screening. In 1981, she was the general editor of A New View of a Woman's Body and was an editor of a companion book, How to Stay Out of the Gynecologist's Office. In 1984, she assisted in writing Woman-Centered Pregnancy and Birth. In 1992, she wrote A Woman's Book of Choices with Rebecca Chalker. She is on the board of directors of the Feminist Women's Health Centers of California and has served on the board of directors of the National Abortion Federation. I spoke with her way back in October after meeting her in New Mexico, where she gave a talk about reproductive sovereignty. Here's that interview. First, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm really thrilled to do it.
This is a very broad question, but I wonder if you can just start by telling me a bit about your background. You know, what was your life like before you got involved in the reproductive sovereignty movement? Where did you grow up? Things like that.
Well, I was born in Oklahoma, and my family came to California at a time when many people from Oklahoma were migrating to California. This is the time of the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. Not that they were direct sufferers from that. They were in a different part of the state. However, it was a depression, and many of the young people, left to go to California where things were happening. But so I grew up in California. However, since my mother had several other children, and she went back to visit each time and stayed there a few months or even longer, I sort of, have a foot in Oklahoma too. and as a child, I much preferred it. As I began to get older, I realized that there are a lot more opportunities in California, but I love the freedom and the friendliness of people and that sort of thing. I grew up here in the suburb in Glendale, and basically I would say it was fairly typical, other than the fact that my family was that of an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. And he was an accountant. He was kind of a businessman. He along with his friends who liked to make these plans while sitting at the bar and start businesses and things. And they did. He led a pretty interesting life, but the rest of us sort of got the short shrift at home, in terms of clothes and food and so forth. So I sort of grew up class-wise with a middle-class background in one way, because both my parents taught in a business college owned by my grandparents in Oklahoma, But they, in California, why, they were just scrambling to try to make a living. And so I saw both sides of that. And it kind of, I think, very much affected me later on as far as my being in a movement that was pretty dominated by middle-class women. And, you know, feeling not necessarily, I did not feel left out, but I definitely realized that the women that I was dealing with had just not had some of the experiences that I had had, and that they tended to be, well, for example, if they wanted to have a project or something, their first thought was, well, who can we get funding from? You know, it never occurred to them to figure out how to get things done themselves. And, you know, so that I did sort of have a little bit of distinction from my fellows. But other than that, we were all pretty much in the same boat. But I think it turned out to be an asset for me and for everybody that was, you know, part of the organization, because we happened to get into something that you don't get funded for, which was learning how to do abortions. You know, that does not appeal to funders. So it was good that I had sort of learned that entrepreneurialism at a very early stage from my dad. And not that I wasn't criticized for it, because I was. Not just me, but our whole group. In fact, that was the specific charge with people. You're so entrepreneurial. And they said it as an insult. Today, it's very common and widespread in the women's movement to be entrepreneurial. But at that time, it was frowned upon. Of course, as an adult, I, like all the other women in my generation, I got married and had kids. And I turned out to have 6 of them. And that, since my husbands, I was married twice, and neither one of my husbands were able to support us in, what shall I say, we made it, but it was always a struggle. But I enjoyed having my kids very much, and I did not enjoy the housework and did it as little as possible. But, you know, my interests were, well, I was definitely very concerned about the world in general, you know, history and reading, etc. But I also was not a feminist. That came later. And in fact, I would have to say, up until the time that I underwent a personal, very profound change, I was pretty conservative. And I was even critical of the younger women at the, because by this time, I was about 30. And I was critical of the women at the university that were demanding birth control in their clinics. You know, I thought, well, it's all right that you're having sex. I wasn't disapproving of that, but I just thought they should be responsible and deal with that themselves. I was somewhat judgmental. So you can see I had a big change, mainly because my way of dealing with life was not working out. I was being a good woman. And, you know, probably one of the nicest people you'd run across in terms of politeness and friendliness and helpfulness, et cetera. And it just was not getting me anywhere. Not at all. And I came to see that I was being very judgmental. That was the very realization that I had was that, you know, by fitting in and being a good woman, that, you know, I was really buying into my own oppression.
And so when you say that it wasn't working out for you, what do you mean specifically, you know, in what areas of your life was it not working?
Well, for one thing, you know, I had dropped out of college with my first pregnancy, and later I went back to school at night, and you know, I just was progressing pretty slowly in that respect, and we were not getting ahead, and as I had assumed that we would. And I think mostly as a housewife, I wasn't respected. And that really made me very angry that, you know, society was very demanding as far as if you had children, how you had to take care of them, keep them healthy, et cetera, all of which I worked very hard to do. But you know, if I went to my husband, by the way, my first husband, he went to school while and worked part time while, you know, we were raising the kids, and then he graduated as a teacher, and so we would go to his you know, staff parties, things like that, and then people would meet me, and in the course of conversation, they'd say, "Oh, well, Carol, what, you know, what do you do?" And I'd say, "Oh, I have, you know, four children, and I keep house." And they'd say, "Oh, that's great. That is so important." Mm. And then they'd just turn on their heels and walk away, and I'd never see them again. And, I mean, the message was pretty clear that I had nothing to contribute to this social event because I was a housewife. And that really, you know, was one of the things that was quite irritating to me. Plus, I was beginning to get very disenchanted with our politics in this country, with the, you know, the racism and the Vietnam War. All these things were increasingly obvious to me that, you know, we lived in a very imperialist country, and the people around me were still very satisfied with everything. In fact, one of my experiences was going with my daughter, who was at that point, you know, 17, and with my husband, and then we went to a anti-war demonstration called the Chicano Moratorium. And that happened to be a very historic event, and we happened to be right in the middle of it. And the sheriff's department, this is in East L.A., and it was, you know, mostly Chicanos who were protesting the fact that so many people of color were being killed in the war. And we were under attack by, well, I think it was about 20 busloads of sheriffs that had pulled up and circled the park while we were in there having our picnic lunch and playing music and speaking and that sort of thing. And then they launched this attack on us. And, you know, it was really very shocking, and I went back to my neighborhood, and after it was all over, and I was really shocked at what had happened, and I was telling everybody about it, and their response was, I mean, several of these people said that, "Well, what were you doing there?" Mm. So that was their response. So you could see I had moved very far away from my, you know, people that I had worked very hard, like with my Girl Scout activities and other community things that I was involved with. I was suddenly, you know, persona non grata. And not that I wanted to fit in. I mean, I could have, but I didn't want to at that point. And I tried to, you know, branch out, but, you know, I had a hard time. I had some very, very lonely times. I would say for about a year, I was really isolated and torn. And, you know, here I was, you know, with my family of kids. I wasn't part of the movement at that time. You know, there was a huge movement going on, but I, even though my husband and I, that's why we were at the Chincana Moratorium, is that we joined the Mexican American Political Association. And so I was working politically at that level, but I wasn't really making a change in the way that I wanted to.
And was your husband on board with your sort of political direction at this point?
I'm laughing because you just said the most absolutely predictable thing that every single person I ran into. Well, what does your husband think about this?
I mean, I suppose like my real question is like, you said you enjoyed having children, and I wondered if you enjoyed being married.
Well, by this time I was married to my second husband. My first husband unfortunately contracted tuberculosis when my children were very young, and he was hospitalized for over a year and had extensive surgery and lung surgery. And when he got out, of course, during that time I was on getting welfare and so forth with my kids. He just never really got back into the swing of things. He did finish his education, his teaching education, that I just spoke about. But he, was drinking alcohol. And as I saw him, going through this pattern that I knew from my childhood, I just did not want to be part of that. And I did go to therapy. That's at a time when, that was just, what you do. You went to a therapist, which, by the way, I did find to be very helpful. And I got quite enthusiastic about therapy at that time. This, as I say, this is pre-feminist days, so I didn't recognize that the therapists were in the very best of intentions, I'm sure, helping me to fit in better in my role and that make my marriage work. At a certain point, my therapist told me, she said, you have a good provider as your husband, because at that point he was graduated and he started making a decent salary. She said, and, you can work with the situation. Like, for example, make sure he eats so he doesn't, when he drinks, he doesn't, make sure doesn't have an effect on him, et cetera. And she told me all these ways I could adjust and make the situation work. Mm. Well, I looked at it and I thought, I don't want to do these things. I don't want to make sure he eats so that he won't get drunk. And that's when I decided to divorce.
What year was
this? Let's see, that was 1959 or 60. Hmm. And, of course, here, back in the same situation as far as the money was concerned. At the very same time that I came to this decision, I had started working on a part-time basis, and I met the man that I subsequently married, with whom I was much more compatible and happy, and had a pretty good marriage. One that I very much miss at this point because he is deceased. You were asking if I was happy with my marriage. So the answer is yes and no, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, my first husband was a very decent, nice person. And I didn't divorce him because I didn't like him. I just didn't want myself or my children to, you know, go through the experience that one has to go through living with an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what led you to get involved in the fight for abortion rights? I don't know if you would call it the fight for abortion rights, would you?
Well, I had, of course, as I said, I had watched the development of this movement mostly on TV. And even in the Chicano movement, there weren't too many people who were feminists. But I was very attracted to I came to realize that what my whole problem was in life was that I didn't like authority, especially, you know, in a patriarchy. What an authority boils down to is someone trying to keep women in their place. And I didn't want to be kept in that place. So when I heard, and I was at work at the time, I heard a radio program saying that announcement that they were going to have a now meeting. The first that got my attention first was they announced that the women had sat in or at the White House, or, you know, they'd picketed the White House, did some kind of sit-in. And that was very exciting to me. And then right after that, they said, and if you're interested, they're having a meeting. So I had my husband take me over to this meeting in Hollywood. And it was, well, first of all, I ran smack dab into the housewife thing again, because I probably was the only housewife in the whole room, a couple hundred women. Mm. You know, they were all professional women. And there were some, you know, graduate students, that kind of thing, you know, but, you know, younger to that extent. But, you know, I really, once again, was the housewife. So at the end of the meeting, they announced to the new attendees, of which I was one, that they had several committees and that they encouraged us to join it. So they listed the committees, and the only one that even came close to being relevant to my life was the abortion committee. I had had an illegal abortion, and so I knew what that was all about, and I really was outraged and still, you know, smarting from the experience, because not only was it painful and you know, scared and had to pay for it, scraping up the money, etc. But also, you know, that I had to get permission from the state to do it. I mean, I would have had to. And that, the fact might, I had another abortion where I did have to, but in this case, you know, I knew that abortion was available in California at that time, but you had to get permission, and I didn't have any access to that. So there was only two other people on the committee, but luckily for me, they were both outstanding women. One was Mary Petrinovich, who was very, at that time, very active in getting the first Earth Day launched. And then the other one was Lana Clark Phelan, who had written the abortion handbook. And Lana was just a very educated, brilliant woman. And she, at that time, we were doing a lot of public speaking, as the NOW chapter was, because abortion was a very, you know, discussed topic, and a lot of groups would call and ask to have a speaker come and address their monthly meeting. So I would go with her and understudy her. So that provided me with a very deep backgrounding into the law and its history and, you know, all of the political facts and the legislative aspect. I mean, she was just an encyclopedia of information. So that was how I got involved with the abortion field, which I subsequently have realized is that I went right into the most pivotal place that exists in our struggle, which is the requirement of legalization of abortion.
How did you learn that women could self-abort?
This was through Mary. Mary was married to a college professor at the Riverside University of California at Riverside. And Riverside is about an hour's drive from Los Angeles. And she would come up to L.A. about once a week with a carload of women who needed abortions. There, you know, that she was sort of a contact on the campus. And an illegal abortionist named Harvey Carman, Dr. Harvey Carman, performed them. So I started learning more about that with Mary. She invited me over to the clinic to visit a very small little storefront on Santa Monica Boulevard in what is now West Hollywood. And, you know, I sort of got involved with the abortion scene, in other words, from that angle. And at one point, after, oh, I don't know, a month or so of different, you know, visits that I'd made, you know, and during this time, by the way, I had the opportunity to actually view a cervix. And it wasn't planned. I mean, no one was, you know, displaying their cervix for my benefit. But I was with Mary, and she was walking around, and she knew the person in the procedure room, and I was just following her as we were talking. And we walked into the procedure room, which in this case was basically just ducking into this very small room in this very small clinic. And here was this woman, she was getting an IUD, and she had the speculum in, and the overhead lamp was, you know, directed into her vagina. So I had a perfect view of the cervix. And I just almost fainted. I mean, the blood went out of my head. I was so utterly shocked at the simplicity of this. I mean, remember, I had been understudying Lana for, at this point, a few months, and becoming more and more enraged that we didn't have legal abortion, but somehow just thinking that we had to go to the legislature to change the law. Of course, as I say, this in California had been changed, but it just was not available. Doctors were not willing to, you know, to actually provide abortion. So it remained up to the illegal abortionist still. At any rate, that rocked me, and it made everything come together for me. I connected all the dots in a split second. Mm-hmm. I realized doctors kept us ignorant, and that's, you know, how they kept us down, that they were in service to the power structure, you know, to keep women under control. That they did, not only did it for profit, which we all, you know, at that time were becoming aware of, but also to control us. So the light bulb went off. So then later, when Mary suggested that we learn how to do abortions, you know, she said, look, it's not that difficult. We could do it. And I said, yeah, we sure could. And there were a few other women that were coming to the clinic on a regular basis and on a very loose, informal basis. And we had this little group of us. And we decided to start doing that. And we actually did learn how to provide abortions on our own.
And what's the process exactly? You know, how does one self-abort?
Well, we were at a clinic where the abortionist had become aware, I think. I mean, later we realized that he claimed to invent it. In fact, he's on the books as having invented it. But I believe that he learned about this method from a doctor in England, a woman, a Dr. Dorothy Kerslake. And it, instead of being the old-fashioned type of abortion that was common at that time, in fact, it was exclusive, was what they call a DNC, which stands for dilation and curettage, or dilatation. At any rate, this, you know, usually requires a anesthetic. Of course, on my illegal abortion, I did not have an anesthetic, and I knew that it was very needed because mm-hmm. I experienced horrible pain. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, having these very sharp instruments inserted into the uterus, which sometimes resulted in perforations that caused a problem, we used this suction. It was a handheld device, and, you know, it was a tube, small tube that was inserted into the cervix and into the uterus, and then suction was applied by pulling a syringe back that it was attached to, and it extracted the contents of the uterus. So this is, we're speaking of an early abortion, 6 to 8 weeks pregnancy. Although it can be used later, but it's approved use in its most, uncomplicated use is in 6 or 8 weeks. So that's what we learned. And we found that, you know, we did a lot more complicated things in our lives than that. I mean, there were a lot of things, you know, just even, stuffing a turkey or something, that might take a lot more skill than you needed to do an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you had to be, the main thing about abortion that determines the safety is, first of all, having the right equipment for the duration of the pregnancy that you're dealing with. And secondly, having, sterile conditions and anesthesia. And those are the things that are vital. But the actual technical skill is not that great.
And what's menstrual extraction?
Hmm?
What's menstrual
what
extraction?
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, menstrual extraction is different than abortion. And this was developed after our small group brought in a much larger number of women and started teaching self-exam. And one of our members, Lorraine Rossman, took that little device and modified it so so that we could, with very minimal training, do it in groups. And this was based on the idea of extracting the contents of the uterus, whether you were pregnant or not. And it because of the improved equipment and the fact that it was done without anesthesia, it obviated the need for anesthesia, and it reduced the risk of perforation. And since we were working in a friendship group, if there was the other main complication of an early abortion, is that it might be incomplete. But when you keep together and you monitor how the woman's feeling, you can detect that it isn't incomplete, and you get back together and you redo it and you finish it. So it just literally makes it an extremely safe procedure that's done with a friendship group, as compared to an abortion where the person providing the abortion doesn't know the person. They come in, it's a service. They have to examine them and test them to make sure that the pregnancy is, you know, not too far along. That's very important. And they also have to include facilities for anesthesia and the follow-through. So they're distinctively different procedures, even though both can involve a pregnancy.
Okay, and thanks for clarifying that. I appreciate it. And so menstrual extraction, the purpose can sometimes be to end a pregnancy, but not always.
Is correct, right? Yeah. Okay. First of all, it's a wonderful way to learn how to do abortions is by starting out by extracting each other's menstrual periods. That's where you learn to handle a cannula and where you learn about how to evaluate the size and shape of the uterus, that sort of thing. And so it's a very good training tool. But also, for various reasons, women want to extract their period. And, first and foremost is to get to know more about our bodies. By learning to do it, you learn so much more about your cycle, about how your body reacts to things, and you just become it's a level of knowledge that is extremely interesting. And menstrual extraction groups have discovered a variety of things that the medical profession isn't even aware of because they never do this. But lastly, of course, it can be to extract a period. A pregnancy.
And what kind of pushback did you get when you started doing these abortions and doing, menstrual extractions, self-exams, and teaching other women how to do these things as well?
The most immediate pushback was that I was arrested. I and another woman were arrested. They did not have any specific information that we were providing abortions because, for one thing, we were under surveillance at that time. Unknowingly, we didn't realize we were. But we were offering these self-exam classes where we didn't even do menstrual extraction. We just learned about our cervixes. And a woman who worked for the department, the medical board, she volunteered. I think she was a secretary or something. Anyway, she came to observe us, on a false, pretenses. and made a report that resulted in our arrest. But at that point, the reason that we weren't providing abortions on our own was because we had the whole field had opened up in the interim. Things were changing very rapidly at that time. So within a few months, where before it was unavailable, there was a number of doctor's offices that had opened up that were providing they weren't doctor's offices, they were hospitals that were providing abortion. They were not regular hospitals, which is why I made that mistake. They were industrial hospitals in the part of town where, you know, with factories, and where they're there to deal with the workers that get injured on the job, that kind of thing. And so they're just very small medical facilities, but they are licensed as a hospital. And because the regular hospitals still would not do abortions for women. The actual established medical profession is so anti-abortion. It took a long time to get doctors to be willing to provide abortions. So now, you know, that's how it was at that moment. So when they arrested me, there were no abortions being done on our part at that particular moment in time. Although we had been, of course, and we had started doing menstrual extraction, but not at our facilities. So they were never going to find that either. But they charged us with practicing medicine without a license. And Colleen Wilson, who was my co-defendant, was just about to take her boards to become a teacher. She was, it was very inopportune for her to have to stand trial. So she plea bargained to one count of having fit a diaphragm. I mean, that she don't, which here again was a demonstration. We didn't provide diaphragms in our clinics, our self-help clinics. We just showed women how it worked. You know, we had a set of diaphragm of different sizes. And the idea was to demystify it, for women to realize that there was nothing, you know, it was no more difficult to fit a diaphragm to yourself than trying on and getting the shoe that fits you. You know, it's just a fit. And, I mean, that type of thing is, we'd all been for years paying, you know, $100 to $300 to get a diaphragm and thinking there was something very mysterious about it, when it was just the doctor had a graduated set, and, you know, put them in until found one that fit. I mean, that was very typical. I did go to trial. And it attracted national attention. And one reason is because Lorraine and I had gone on a cross-country tour just about 3 months prior to this, 3 or 4 months, that we had visited campuses and now chapters to introduce the idea of self-exam. And we had distributed speculums, you know, to do self-exam, and we had sold alums, and just in general spread this word very broadly around the country. So it was just a matter of calling all of our contacts, you know, to let them know that we've been busted for this thing to acquire national prominence. So I did go to trial. And the jury acquitted me. And I think that was partly because we made the argument, which basically said that we qualified for the exemption. There was an exemption to the statute that said family members could do things for each other without it being practicing a medicine. And we said, well, that's what we're doing, you know. We're just in this, you know, friend relationship, and you know, that applies to us. And the jury agreed.
Great. I wonder, actually. So, how did you fund this tour that you did around the country, teaching women how to do self-examination? Speaking of entrepreneurship.
Well, we didn't fund it to the extent of paying ourselves a salary, but we were able to pay all of our travel expenses and food and lodging, etc. By being invited by these groups, we sent a notice around the country, and we plotted our, you know, ideal route, and we estimated where we would be each of the spots, you know, on the road. I mean, we gave them a window, you know, said we will be there between such and such a date and another, that I don't know what we would have done if everybody had responded, because it would have been conflicts, because we double scheduled ourselves to some extent. But it turned out perfectly. We had some minor adjustments, but basically we set up this meeting, and we stopped at 23 different places and held a self-help clinic, sold speculums, books, took donations, stayed at people's houses, and they fed us, and we just did fine. And it even paid our bus fare. We went by bus.
Oh, great. Tell me about the Great Yogurt Conspiracy.
Well, I just did. That was the self-help clinic. That was at that time. But the way it got that name was that we were doing this weekly self-help clinic at the health center. You know, our offices. It was not a clinic, but it was just our offices. And we also, you know, had a room where we provided very basic types of services. Like, for example, maybe I remember pulling out a few IUDs for women, that kind of thing. Nothing elaborate, but just increasing our overall knowledge. And as part of this, a woman who was an ex-nun, we found this part out later, she brought a group of older teenagers, you know, to see what this is all about. And so we did a demonstration for the group. And during this demonstration, well, actually, I was going to get up and, you know, put the speculum in and so forth. But it so happened that one of the women in our group had a yeast condition, and so she came in the room and she said, "I wonder if you could help me insert this yogurt. I just went across the street and got it, and I have a yeast condition." And I said, "That's great. That's exactly what we do." And so she got up on the table, and by the way, this happened to be a woman called Z. Budapest, which you may not be aware of, but she went on to become a very well-known witch, wrote several books. She's still very active and prominent in the Bay Area, you know, in San Francisco and Oakland. And so Z was the person that got the yogurt put in her vagina. Well, this ex-nun was just completely weirded out and upset. So she reported us to the health department, you know, which is what prompted this other woman to do the undercover investigation. So, as a consequence, yogurt was on their list of evidence to seize you know, that had been part of our crime, was putting in yogurt. And so the investigators went into the kitchen to look in the refrigerator and started to take out the yogurt. But one of the staff people said, "Hey, don't take that. That's my lunch." And fortunately, they didn't. That wouldn't have been any good anyway. It had fruit in it. And we don't put flavored yogurt in. And that just, it just reached the height of the absurdity. So we, that was how we boys referred to it, the great yogurt conspiracy.
It's funny because I recently interviewed this woman, Dr. Jen Gunter, who's, I guess, become quite well known. She just published a book called The Vagina Bible. But one of her main crusades is against sort of what she calls wellness. So she says she debunks myths. And one of the myths that she says she's debunking is the idea that using things like yogurt and probiotics will fix yeast infections. And I was surprised to hear that because probiotics are obviously often used to cure yeast infections.
Well, first of all, did you say eat yogurt or use it in the vagina?
Use it in the vagina. I didn't say, but that's what I meant, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry to disillusion her. She obviously is, you know, doesn't have much experience because we've used it extensively and it's very effective. And it has a very good grounding in a scientific explanation, which I'm surprised she didn't know that. I mean, I haven't read the book and I don't know where she's coming from, but it shows a very typical ignorance that people assume women wouldn't know what they're talking about, so they just say on the old thing, and they're usually believed. But the vagina has a environment. You know, we have, first of all, we have secretions. We have our mucus during our ovulation. And then just on a regular basis, the vaginal walls secrete a mucus that cleanses our vagina to, you know, gravity. I mean, that's the way of keeping this mucous membrane both, you know, supple and moist and free of, you know, harmful infection. However, it is open to the outside. So that means that various organisms are there at all times in that normal flora. And there's bacteria, and there's other kinds of organisms that, if they're in small enough number, don't cause a problem. But if they overgrow, they become a problem. And one reason that this happens, well, like, for example, in real hot weather, like right now in L.A., it's very hot. And if I were to be in a self-help group and we were everybody do self-examination, I can tell you that most of us would have some amount of yeast in our vagina. And this yeast, which is always present in a vagina in small numbers, takes over because it of the heat it's promoted, and it eats the normal bacteria that's supposed to be there. It overgrows. And this overgrowth of yeast causes sometimes it doesn't cause anything other than just a whitish discharge that smells like bread, you know, and because it's yeast. But with some people, even a very small of these overgrowth of yeast, even if it isn't visible to the naked eye, development of horrible irritation can be extremely irritating. And another thing that makes it overgrow is eating a lot of sugar, because that really makes it, you know, the yeast feeds on the sugar, and, you know, the and here again, overgrows. So when you put in yogurt, now, where also where this person that you mentioned, where she may have seen it not be successful, is if women don't put anything in that has the bacteria that's in the yogurt, which is the lactobacillus. That's what takes care of the yeast. It eats the yeast. And it's a very natural kind of situation. It, you know, the yeast goes away. And your vagina is restored to its normal flora. But if you were to put in one that had sugar, or if you were to put one in that had been processed in such a way that it didn't have any live lactobacillus, of course it's not going to be effective. So that's possibly what has misled her.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you clarifying all that. Thank you. I wanted to move on to ask you yet another really big question that we talked about a bit when I met you in Albuquerque, and I found it really fascinating. I mean, essentially, I want you to tell me everything you know about the clitoris.
First of all, let me tell you the thing that about the clitoris is that what it basically is. The clitoris per se, the most narrow definition of the clitoris is that it is erectile tissue that is located in our female sex organ, and it's equivalent to the erectile tissue that's in a penis. And that the difference is that in a penis, it's contained in a tube of, you know, skin. And so therefore, when it gets when it swells, it makes the penis become hard. And that, or, you know, harder. And so we notice it quite a bit. In the case of the female sex organ, which is a lot more than just the clitoris, why this also does equal swelling. In fact, there's more erectile tissue in a female, and it swells, and sometimes very much. But this swelling is not as noticeable because it just has all the room it needs to expand. It doesn't have to get hard. It just gets swollen. When we wrote our book, we wrote a book in 1980, and we called it The Rediscovery of the Clitoris. And the reason that we used the term clitoris, and looking back, I second-guess our decision, but I don't know if we would have done anything different even now. We decided to refer to the female sex organ as the clitoris, because our other choice would have been to invent a new term. And we just did not think it was realistic for us to say, you know, the reinvention of the female sex organ, or the reinvention of the, you know, blah, 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 you know. That's very, very hard. So we stuck with the term clitoris because that was one term women knew. But we went ahead and described the whole female sex organ. At least there are some parts of it that we were not aware of. And I'm sure that anatomists now, even who are doing it, there are small structures or, you know, parts that may emerge. Basically, it consists of what we call the clitoris in our book, or what I'm calling now the female sex organ. Consists of the erectile tissue, it consists of the blood vessels, the muscles, the nerves, and the all of the little strictures or valves that, you know, shut the close off the urethra, you know, that stops the flow of the urine, that sort of thing. So it's quite a complex organ. Actually, it consists of exactly the same categories as the male genitals, just arranged in a slightly different way. And of course, that makes all the difference in our experience of it. But these parts all work together. For example, let's take the blood vessels, for example. The blood vessels can flow both ways in our genitals. You know, like in the rest of our body, the blood vessels, you know, go around, circulate pretty much in the same direction. But in our organ, when we're getting erect, when we're getting aroused, and blood is coming into the organ, it's flowing in. Then when we are stimulated and we get extremely the height of excitement, the muscles contract all at once, all together, and force that blood out. And then those blood vessels go, same goes in the opposite direction. Same as the nerves. The nerve stimuli come down in one direction, and at a certain point they reverse and go the other. As they say, this is similar to the male idea. So there is an orchestration that goes on in the sex organ where all of these parts work together. And, I mean, every orgasm is different. I think women that experience orgasms, which most of us do, but not all, we know that, you know, sometimes it can be a very pleasurable but kind of brief and diffused feeling. And other times, like I say, the earth moves. I mean, it's just a tremendous difference. And sometimes we have more than one. So we also ejaculate. Now, it's hard to say at this point because it's never really been studied. But my guess is that of all the women who experience orgasm, at least, you know, 95% of those women have ejaculated. However, since it is not recognized by the medical profession that this happens, they still haven't, you know, accepted the fact that it does. They say it's still open to dispute. Anyway, that if they studied it, they'd find that women do ejaculate, but they mistake it as urination. Or they may... it may get mixed in with other secretions, you know, and then get annoy the male secretions, you know, with the semen. So the actual number that tends to be the common figure of how many is, you know, like maybe 30% of women ejaculate or some such thing. But that's just a very... soft estimate, to make a pun, because, as I say, it has not been rigorously studied. And it probably isn't going to be because of all the secrecy and complexities of getting people to participate in studies. This, by the way, is not described in the anatomy textbooks. You can buy the most expensive, most up-to-date, beautifully illustrated, you know, anatomy book, like Gray's Anatomy. And you will not find what I'm describing to you. You will find it, actually, but it is separated, and you'll have to go to the section on the bladder to find out about the urethra, which is part of the female sex organ, you know, but not, it isn't commonly thought of that way.
Why why are women's bodies and sexualities and reproductive systems so taboo still? You know, it seems like we all know so little.
Well, I'll just cut to the chase here and give you the direct answer, which is in the mid-19th century, scientists were able to, using the microscope, figure out how fertilization happened. They saw the sperm entering the egg. But prior to that, it has always been thought that it took, the woman had to participate, had to have have an orgasm in order to have, fertilization. They were not clear. They knew some of this, but not the whole picture. Well, at that very point in time, or the century prior to it, several anatomists, two in particular, did the work that outlined everything I'm telling you. It was done in that time. One was named de Graaf, and he did the dissection, and he showed all these parts that I've listed, and that they worked together. You know, this was all known. Another one named Kobelt did the same thing, made meticulous. He was German. De Graaf was Dutch. And Kobelt made these exquisitely drawn things that just went into all of this and showed it so that there was no dispute. Well, I'm making the connection that once they found out how, you know, fertilization happened, they were not interested in how women did or didn't have any sexual experience. They found out, you know, you can be unconscious. In fact, we probably are asleep much of the time when fertilization occurs, because after that semen has been deposited and the sperm wake their way up through the tubes and go into the uterus and meet up with the egg. That can be hours, or even I forget how many, what the maximum can be, but I think it could be up to a day or something. So the two events are completely not associated. And so they dropped it. And that was they completely dropped it. Some feminists have written very important papers where they surveyed Adele Clark, who was the main author, where they went through hundreds of gynecology texts, and they either found the clitoris completely omitted or just a little bump on the profile, the side profile of the genitals, where all you would see was that little pea-sized bump. And that was, and everything behind it was blank space. Just, filled with fat or something that, was not delineated. And so that information has not been available, and it was not available when we wrote our book. But we went and found those articles, well, de Graaf in particular. And then, of course, it was a couple hundred years old, But we talked with each other, and we compared our orgasms and how we reacted, and we read this material. I mean, it took us months, you know, of studying this and experiencing it and relating it to our own experience and saying, yeah, that sounds right. That's what it is for me. And we used that to validate what we were reading, and that's what our book was based on. But even today, as I say, in Grey's Anatomy, if you want to see how the muscles work and how the perineum works, you have to go to a different section. It's not in the chapter devoted to, our genitals. So, it covers the penis, but the reason... It isn't just sexism. I mean, this is, of course, terribly injurious to women, but there is another explanation that has not anything to do with sexism. It just has to do with them focusing on reproduction, is that they can't talk about the penis without talking about these things. In other words, with a man... Reproduction is directly 100% linked with that man having an orgasm and, you know, ejaculating. If that doesn't happen, there's not going to be any fertilization.
Right.
So they're sort of stuck with that because they're very prudish. They don't even like talking about men. And in fact, in Grey's Anatomy, they don't even talk about orgasm. They don't use the word. They use all the component words, of course, to talk about, you know, erection and ejaculation, etc. But they don't use orgasm. That's just a little too real for them. So I don't know if this answers your question.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, I have to let you go at some point, so I guess... It may as well be soon, as it's been almost an hour and a half now. So, yeah, again, I appreciate all your time. This has been really fascinating. I guess, finally, I wondered what you're up to now. What are you up to these days?
Well, I am super, super, super busy. I think I may have finally bitten off more than I can chew. For years and years, as I said, I had that insight when I saw my first cervix. I got it, you know, how much the society, a patriarchal society, is organized to control our reproduction. But now that I am not working full time, at any particular job, I have been devoting myself to really carrying this further and trying to help women to understand how we are targeted and who's doing it and how. Because right now we're fighting the abortion battle blind. We go out and we wave signs and we yell and we scream and we try to vote for the people that will vote our way or something. But until we understand that all nations want to control their population, whether they're socialist, communist, or capitalist, they all are dominated by men, therefore they don't see the necessity of bringing women into this discussion, and they just regulate the laws, they regulate the access to medications and equipment and so forth to limit women's choices. And now they've even carried it to a fine art because, with this neoliberal economy where they manipulate the interest rate and the flow of money and, you know, how much and lowering of taxes to reduce the amount of tax dollars available to do anything, and taking it away from the regular people, they have created a situation where most women, you know, may or may not want to have a child, or what they'll never know, because it's out of the question for them. It will be so hard to do, and so many women are deciding that no children. Of course, many women, I'm sure, would make a decision not to have children, even if it were super easy to do so, because that's just your choice. But we really will never know at this point, because our choices are so conditioned by these outer forces that we really never get in touch with what we ourselves would really want to do in our life. And of course, we make that decision based on, for example, I was talking to someone today, and she was noting that she was at the playground, and she saw, she herself is a nanny, so she saw this little boy who's usually there with his nanny, and he was not a very friendly little kid. He was kind of a little bit combative with other kids. Anyway, his mom was there that day, and he was on the swing, and he said, "Mom, would you come over and give me a push?" And she said, "No, you can do it yourself. You can, you know how to push." And she had a pump, and she was busy on the phone. And my friend said, "Well, it just makes you wonder, why would someone have a child if they really didn't want to be with them?" And I said, "Well, you know, if we had a society organized by women, women would have such a different situation. I mean, first of all, if they didn't want to, they wouldn't have to get married or have a significant other to help raise this child, or they would be able to make the money to support it on their own, or they would, you know, have other means to deal with these situations and have birth control, so that they already wouldn't have children unless it was really their choice. And but we would make a society that provided child care, provided respite care, so that those kinds of situations wouldn't even be the norm. You know, it's because we have to shoehorn our desires into a patriarchal society that these really warped decision-making processes is all we have available. So that's what I'm about. That's what I'm trying to, and it's just turning out to be a much bigger job than I ever imagined. So wish me luck on that. Yeah.
Good luck.
thank you. I mean, everything I've always suspected is turning out to be 100% proof. In fact, even worse than I thought. The more I investigate, the more I... In fact, if I keep on at this rate, I'm probably going to be over in some park up on a park bench, you know, just yelling at everybody about it. it's kind of crazy, amazing. It's so awful.
I'm curious to know, before I let you go, and then I promise I will let you go, how do you respond? And I'm just curious because, I mean, the abortion debate in the U.S. in particular is so weird and polarized. But, you know, what people say over and over and over again, people who are opposed to abortion, is that, you know, it's killing an innocent life, right? So what do you say to people, out of curiosity, when they say things like that to you?
Well, I can be facetious, I mean, of course, I just tell them don't have one. But, no, I do respect people's feelings about this, and it is, and I understand how someone could be very upset and shocked at the idea that it would become necessary to, as you say, kill an innocent life, okay? And, of course, the reason that these things come to pass is because we do have such an unfair society and one that is not run for women. We don't have birth control, at least not safe, effective ones that we can get easily, and when our children are not valued, all these things. So women are pushed and pulled, and they're, because of all of these circumstances, abortion is unwanted pregnancy is going to continue to be a reality in life. Just as for similar reasons, war is still out there. And we don't approve of shooting and killing people either in a wartime situation. But we do vote for a government that funds troops to go out and kill or be killed. You know, I just tell them, please, would you direct yourself to the larger problem instead of being judgmental of the person who finds themselves caught up in the these contradictions and have these things happen. Don't judge them. Don't be judgmental. Go out and make a better world. And, you know, that's what it really comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And again, thank you for all your time and your work. I mean, this has been probably one of my favorite podcast conversations ever. So I'm really glad to have connected with you and had the opportunity to talk with you about all this.
Well, me too. And I enjoy hearing it. Thank you very much, Megan.
You just heard an interview with Carol Downer. Carol is an immigration lawyer, author, and activist in Los Angeles. She serves on the board of directors of the Feminist Women's Health Centers of California, continues to fight for women's liberation, and give talks about reproductive sovereignty. Carol is currently working on her next book, in which she advances the belief that women's collective efforts to achieve their sexual and reproductive liberation is a fundamental strategy for social change. She was born in Oklahoma in 1933. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.